All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is April 14th, and we're going to finish up peripheral nervous system, move into autonomic nervous system today. And maybe some of you have noticed that the Cypress College server has disappeared where I put my lectures online, and it's gone away forever. And so teachers don't have server support from Cypress College anymore. So I'm going to buy a hosting service at UHost or someplace and upload the lectures to that site, then I'll send you an email. So maybe over the weekend I'll be able to do that. So even though I'm recording the lecture right now, I really don't have any place to put it. If I might be able to put it on Blackboard, but there's a limit as to the file size in Blackboard, and these lectures are like 15 megabytes, and that's kind of over the limit. So you'll just have to stand by with that. And maybe I can do it this weekend, maybe not. I'm not sure. All right, otherwise we'll figure out another way to do that. Maybe I'll put them on a disk and put them in the reserve section in the library if that's really important for you to be able to download them. Okay, so that's all I know. Now, did I put your grades in Blackboard for the last test? Okay, good. So I think we're pretty much caught up with everything. So does anybody have any questions regarding central nervous system, peripheral nervous system so far? So far, so good? Okay. All right, well, we were talking about peripheral motor endings, and this is the junction between a motor neuron and an effector organ. And so I want to make sure you have straight in your mind what the definitions for these things are. So what is a motor neuron? What does a motor neuron do? Efferent, it takes information from CNS into the periphery. That's right. And what are the effector organs? What are the possible effector organs?
Glands.
You got glands. I like that. Glands. That's a good one.
Muscle.
What kind of muscle?
Skeletal
muscle is one.
Cardiac
muscle is another. And smooth muscle is another kind of muscle. So we got a bunch of different kinds of muscle. All right. Now, motor neurons, depending on what the exact effector organ is, the motor neurons will belong to a different class of neurons, right? And there are two major classes of motor neurons. If you look way back to the introductory chapter. Huh? We might lose the lamp. If we lose the lamp, I don't know what we're going to do. Go to Bolsa Chica or something. We'll see. Okay? But what are the two classes of motor neurons, the two main classes? Okay, there is. Ah, really good, really good. There's autonomic, right? And then there is somatic, right? Somatic and autonomic. And somatic is just a fancy term for voluntary. And what is the only thing you have voluntary control of in your whole body?
Skeletal
muscle. So when we say somatic, it means a motor neuron going to a skeletal muscle. And that's it. All right, the autonomic nervous system, on the other hand, goes to all the rest of the effector organs. What's left over? You've got glands, which you can't control voluntarily, right? Can't control your sweat glands. Glands. Heart muscle. You can't control your heart. Now, you can play tricks. You can meditate and things like that. But you can't really control it like a skeletal muscle. All right? So glands, cardiac muscle, and what else?
Smooth
muscle. And again, that's involuntary. All of those things are involuntary, right? So the involuntary effector organs are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. And the junction between a motor neuron and the effector organ is different depending on whether it's a somatic synapse or a visceral synapse or an autonomic synapse. So that's what we're talking about here. Innervation to skeletal muscle, the neuromuscular junctions, have plates. All right, so here we talked about this one already. Here's a neuromuscular junction, and the chemical signal is released from this neuron only at the tips of the axons at the neuromuscular junction. So right in this region right here, this neuron does not release the neurotransmitter. And as a matter of fact, you should probably know what that neurotransmitter is in 100% of the cases for this somatic motor neuron. That is going to be acetylcholine. And of course, once you stimulate this muscle with acetylcholine, you don't want that muscle to be contracted for the rest of your life, right? So there should be something that breaks acetylcholine down rather rapidly so the muscle can relax. Unless you want it to contract again, then you send another signal to contract that muscle. So the action of acetylcholine should be short-lived here at the neuromuscular junction, and there is an enzyme that breaks acetylcholine down, and that's what you have in your notes. What's the name of that enzyme that breaks acetylcholine down, which allows this muscle fiber to relax? That is acetylcholine esterase. That's what breaks acetylcholine down. Okay. So when you look at this slide right here, how many motor neurons does it take to get from the central nervous system all the way to this skeletal muscle fiber? How many neurons do you see right there? I see a cell body right here. Right, and then this is an axon that goes all the way. So it only takes one motor neuron for a somatic pathway. All right, so who can tell me what area of the spinal cord is this right here that has this cell body? Okay, anterior horn. And why is it color a dark color right here? It's gray matter. Yeah, because there's dendrites and cell bodies, and you see the cell body right there. And what can you tell me? What's surrounding the cell body? And it's kind of a negative question. There's something that's not surrounding the cell body that makes this area look gray. There's no myelin around the cell body. That's why this looks like a gray area right here. As opposed to along the axon, it's myelinated, so all of this material here looks white, looks like white matter. Okay. So that's important. So remember, neurotransmitter is released only at the axon terminus for a somatic motor neuron. As opposed to these neurons right here. This is a partial illustration of a motor neuron, but this is an autonomic motor neuron. And we got a whole chapter to talk about these guys right here. But notice, I don't even see an axon terminus anywhere, right? Because this neuron, this axon travels for a long distance, and each one of these little swellings right here is what we call a varicosity. And these are the structures of an axon that store neurotransmitter in synaptic vesicles and release that neurotransmitter, right, when an action potential comes down this neuron right here. So there is a whole string of synapses for an autonomic motor neuron, not just one right at the axon tip, but there's a string, and we call these synapses in passant sometimes, synapses in passing. Right, so when an action potential comes down this neuron, it stimulates this varicosity to release neurotransmitter, and this one, and this one, and this one, and all of these all along this pathway right here, not just the tip of the neuron. So that's a pretty important difference. And here is a cross-section maybe of the digestive tract. And as a matter of fact, okay, can anybody tell me how many subdivisions are there to the autonomic nervous system? There are two. Yeah, really good, because we haven't talked about that yet. Anybody know the names by chance? Parasympathetic and sympathetic, right? So as a matter of fact, an autonomic effector organ might receive innervation from both of those. It might be dually innervated. It might have both parasympathetic and sympathetic innervation. Again, that's a big contrast compared to a somatic motor pathway, which only receives innervation from one source, only from the somatic motor neuron. It has single innervation, while smooth muscle and glands and cardiac muscle can be dually innervated, both by the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about some peripheral nerves by location. All right, so what are the two main areas of the central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. And both of those will issue peripheral nerves. So peripheral nerves can come from the brain or they can come from the spinal cord. And if they come from the brain, if they issue forth from the brain, we call those cranial nerves. If they come from the spinal cord, then we call those spinal nerves, right? So those are the two main distinctions. Maybe we talked about that. There are 12 pairs of cranial nerves. And anybody remember how many pairs of spinal nerves are there that come from the whole length of the spinal cord? There are 31, right. Okay. Now, the cranial nerves do have names as well as numbers. The spinal nerves, you don't have to know the names of them, but they really only have numbers anyway, determined by the level of what vertebrae that they come out of the spinal cord from. Okay. All right, so let's talk about cranial nerves first. We said that there were 12 of them. All right, some of them are purely sensory, right? Like for vision and for touch and pain. Cranial nerves number 1, 2, and 8 right here are 100% sensory. So information can only enter the central nervous system. There's no efferent information leaving the CNS through these cranial nerves. Some are somatic motor, which means what? They go to skeletal muscle, voluntary control, like muscles in the head and neck. All right, these are cranial nerves 3, 4, 6, 11, and 12. And some are parasympathetic. Sometimes some of these cranial nerves do support the autonomic nervous system. They have autonomic information flowing through them. And the most important one is cranial nerve number 10. And we're going to call that the vagus nerve, is cranial nerve number 10. All right, and a number of these cranial nerves have mixed function. What does that mean? That means they carry both efferent neurons and afferent neurons, right? It can be go both ways. All right, so those would be 5, 7, 9, and 10 are mixed. All right, so how can you remember? We're going to have to remember the names and numbers of these cranial nerves. So here's a little table for you. Right, so we said that there are 12 cranial nerves. Here are the names of the cranial nerves and their functions. Your book gives an extensive list of their functions. All right, but this is what, if I was going to test you on what the function of a cranial nerve is, this is the only thing that I want you to know. Now, maybe if you get into a clinical program sometime, you're going to have to memorize all of the particular functions of the cranial nerve. So if you want to go ahead and do that right now, that's fine. But for the test coming up, these are the things that I'm going to focus on. Oh, yeah, I want you to know the number, the name, and function. Okay, and some functions are going to be pretty not very detailed, like cranial nerve number 1, that's the olfactory nerve. And that's for the sense of olfaction, and the sense of olfaction is the smell, right? But some of these nerves are pretty complicated in what they do, right? Because sometimes they're sensory and motor together, but I only give you one simple function for that particular nerve, and that's really the only thing I want you to know for a particular nerve. All right, so how are you going to know that, for instance, cranial nerve number 12 right here is called the hypoglossal nerve. And here's a nice little trick which we haven't used so far in this class, but you might want to use this trick in your studies for chemistry or geology or various other things. Sometimes if you have to memorize a list of words that don't make any sense whatsoever, you can come up with a mnemonic to help you memorize the correct order of words that don't have any inherent reason why they have a particular order. Okay, so here is just a mnemonic, which is a little saying, a little rhyme that maybe makes some sense. All right, and the first letter of every word in this mnemonic right here corresponds to the first letter of the list of words that you're trying to memorize. All right, so there's an O in on, and so there's an O in olfactory. All right, so here's a little saying. On old Olympus's towering top, a Finn and German viewed a hop. All right, so I don't know. What does that mean to anybody? What is Olympus? That's a mountain. Mount Olympus in Europe. Okay. And where do Finnish people and German people live? Yeah, which is where? What continent is that? Yeah, that's Europe, right? So here are some Europeans, right, Finns and Germans, that are sitting on this mountaintop right here, and it's a big, big mountain, can be seen from far away, and they're looking over a bunch of valleys, a bunch of farmland, and they're watching what? What's a hop? It's a grain that you make beer out of, all right? So I know you guys don't know much about that kind of stuff, so that's why I thought maybe I would describe that to you, okay? So a hop is a grain that you make beer with, and I guess Finns and German like to drink beer, but they're not the only people in the world, right? And of course, Olympus is what? A really old mountain. All right, so here's a mnemonic. And, all right, so the first three words have O, so that stands for olfactory, optic, oculomotor nerve. And then number cranial nerve number four starts with a T, that's for trochlear. Towering top, that's trigeminal. All right, then A stands for abductions, and fin stands for facial. All right, and then we got AN, that stands for vestibulocochlear nerve. All right, and what is this? What's the function of the vestibulocochlear nerve? Hearing. Yeah, hearing and balance over here. All right, so that corresponds to the A right here. Now, I always get a question, how come there's an A right there, not a V? And I suppose you could say, well, if you turn the A upside down, it kind of looks like a V, but that's not the real reason. Right? The real reason is because years ago, what's the sense of hearing called? Auditory sense, right? So it used to be called the auditory nerve. Right? That's why this little A got put in here instead of the V. But they simplified it, so they simplified it from auditory to vestibulocochlear nerve. Okay? And you'll see why that really makes sense, that it was simplified just in that way. Okay, then we're going to talk about that in a couple chapters coming up. All right, so my first question was, how are you going to know that the hypoglossal nerve is cranial nerve number 12? Because in your mnemonic right here, there's only one word. This is a really easy one. There's only one word that has an H in it, and what's that? Hop. And what number word is that in the mnemonic? Number 12. All right, so that's a relatively easy way to memorize these function, well, at least the names and numbers of the cranial nerves. All right, and there is a website right here that you can go to look up mnemonics on all kinds of things. Maybe you have to memorize stuff about the periodic table in a chemistry class or other things in anatomy. And so you can go to this website right here and look up a mnemonic, or maybe even better yet, make your own up. And I think there's a mnemonic in your textbook that describes the cranial nerves as well. All right, but this is the one that kind of sticks in my mind, but I have no idea why this one sticks in my mind compared to others. Now, when you go to medicalmnemonics.com, okay, make sure you don't use any X-rated mnemonics. Okay, I don't want to see like anybody's writing down X-rated mnemonics on their Scantron during a test. All right, so put the filters on so that you only get the PG mnemonics. All right, so how do you find these cranial nerves? All right, here's an exam figure, and this is going to be helpful for you in lab as well. So we see, what's this right here? Where my cursor's moving. Spinal cord, right, so that's right at the end of the probably medulla oblongata, all right, so that's inferior. And here we have cerebellum, so what is the cerebellum? How would you find the cerebellum? Is it anterior? Yeah, it's posterior. So what's up over here? That is the frontal lobe, that's anterior, right? So as we look at the ventral surface of the brain, underneath the brain, looking from anterior to posterior, the cranial nerves, which are in this yellow or gold color right here, are numbered, 1 being the most anterior and number 12 being the most posterior. So it's relatively easy when you have this diagram to just count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and to find out what nerve there is. So the most anterior, what's the most anterior sense organ on your face? Your nose, right? So that's cranial nerve number 1. That's the olfactory nerve right here. What's the next most anterior sense organ on your face? Your eyes. So here is the optic nerve, right? So cranial nerve 1 and then 2. And then number 3 right here is oculomotor. That helps move your eyeball around. So that's a motor neuron. All right. And then we got number 4 and number 5, trigeminal nerve. All right, so you can just count all of these different nerves down from 1 to 12 to find what they are. And then you just have to remember what their particular names are. So what would you use to remember that cranial nerve number 10 is the vagus nerve? Okay. I would use a mnemonic. Like the V in Vegas corresponds to viewed in that mnemonic that I told you about, right? Viewed a hop, and that's the 10th word in that mnemonic. So that's pretty easy to remember. Okay? All right, now the vagus nerve is pretty important because it carries autonomic signals pretty much all over your body. It's a big, long nerve, and it wanders around all over different places in your body, controlling smooth muscle glands and cardiac muscle as well. And since it wanders all the way around, that's how they named that particular nerve. What's another name for a wanderer that starts with a V? Ooh, it's crossword puzzle time. Vagrant, that's pretty close, probably the same root, but vagabond. So the vagus nerve, since it's kind of wandering around all over your body, we call that the vagabond nerve. Okay, so that's it for cranial nerves. All right, so here is another mnemonic. Remember we said that some cranial nerves are purely sensory, some are purely motor, and then some are mixed. So sometimes somebody might ask you, all right, like cranial nerve number 10. What is that going to be? Is that sensory, motor, or both? Okay, so here is another mnemonic, and it is what? Some say money matters, but my brother says big brains matter most. Okay, so S for sensory, M for motor, so we wanted to know number 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Aha, brains, it's what? It's both, which means what? It means mix. It has both afferent and efferent signals going through it, the vagus nerve. Okay, so this is another pretty handy mnemonic to remember. All right, and so those things you could probably write on your Scantron during the test, you know, in the green area on the back. And you can work those mnemonics to answer some questions on the test. All right, spinal nerves. We talked about spinal nerves maybe a little bit when we looked at the spinal cord, remember? So spinal nerves come from the spinal cord, and spinal nerves all the time are mixed. And they don't enter and leave the spinal cord as a mixed nerve, right? They're either sensory or motor as they're entering and leaving the spinal cord. So what do we call those parts that are entering and leaving the spinal cord? Here we have a pretty good picture, right? So here we see the spinal cord. Here's the spinal nerve right here. So this is mixed. There are both afferent and efferent axons in this nerve right here, but we got the dorsal and ventral root right here. And this is where the function separates. So the dorsal root is 100% what? It's sensory, which is afferent. And the ventral root over here is 100% motor. So roots are a lot different than spinal nerves in terms of their function, right? Spinal nerves are mixed, but the roots are just one or the other. Okay. So what else do I want to say about this slide? Probably a lot of things. Okay. All right, so let's see. We talked about ventral and dorsal roots, the spinal nerve. Okay. All right, so let's take a look at this one. Maybe I'll have to zoom in. Yeah, let's look at this one. I got two pictures to show you what you have to know right here. All right, so I'm going to zoom in just a little bit more. Nice. All right, so who believes me when I say this is the spinal cord? Good. And so you've got the gray matter right here. Here's the white matter, right? And then here is the dorsal root bringing information into the central nervous system. Here's the ventral root bringing it out. And when they converge together, when both the dorsal and ventral root converge together, we get what? The spinal nerve, which of course is mixed. Okay. So here is the spinal cord. So where the heck is the spinal cord in you? Where is it? It's posterior. Kind of right smack in the middle, that's one way to think about it, but it's also what? Really dorsal. As a matter of fact, you can feel your vertebral column, right? All those spinous processes. So it's way posterior. So where is most of your body located with respect to your spinal cord or vertebral column? Is it anterior or posterior? Most of your body is anterior to it, okay? There's just a little bit that's posterior. So there has to be innervation that go to, for instance, back muscles and the skin of your back. And here I see it branching off, right? It's diverging from the spinal nerve. This is what we call a ramus, right? It's not a root, but it's a ramus, and it's going posterior, right? So we call that the dorsal ramus of the spinal nerve, innervating your back, integument, and muscles. While the ventral ramus, right, is going to innervate everything that is anterior to the spinal cord. So guess which ramus is bigger, the dorsal ramus or the ventral ramus? The ventral ramus, because it has to innervate many, many, many millions more cells, right? So it's got to be bigger. All right, furthermore, this ramus right here, what can you tell me about the function? Is it 100% sensory? Is it 100% motor? Or is it mixed? It's going to be mixed. So ramus is always going to carry mixed information, just like the spinal nerve. But what about the roots? One or the other, but never mixed, right? Okay, so that's the big difference between a ramus and a root in terms of their function. Okay. There's a couple other things that I see on this slide, which is really important, and we're going to mention this again when we get to the autonomic nervous system. In certain levels of the spinal cord, namely the thoracic region and the lumbar region, there are sympathetic nerves, which is part of the autonomic nervous system, that leave the spinal cord, and they leave right in this region right here and go to some other tissue, some other nervous tissue that parallels the spinal cord outside the vertebral column. And we call this the sympathetic chain. There are ganglia, right, in various locations. So sympathetic nerves have to leave the spinal nerve and enter the sympathetic chain. So these are like little spinal cords for what kind of information? Sympathetic information, all right? And we're going to talk about what that really means in a little bit. So sympathetic information has to pass through the sympathetic chain. And the way that it gets in and out of the sympathetic chain are through these rami communicantes. All right, so we're going to know the names of both of these when we get to the next chapter. Okay. Where I have the cursor right now, what does that kind of remind you of? What is it? Good. That's the epidural space, right? Outside the meninges, which contains connective tissue and adipose tissue, right? Okay, and then here would be like the dura mater right here, and the pia mater would be right on top of the spinal cord. Okay, here is another view of what we just looked at, and maybe even a nicer view. All right, so here we see the vertebral column with the spinal cord inside. All right, so this is posterior, right, and then here's anterior. In lab, what did you learn to call all of these posterior muscles of the back? Yeah, the erector spinae, right? There's all kinds of muscles, but we just kind of simplify to call them erector spinae. And so here is the dorsal root. Which way are signals going here? Into the spinal cord, but motor signals are leaving the ventral root, right? And then they can, both the dorsal root and ventral root converge together to form a spinal nerve. And then there's a bifurcation right here. So here is the part that goes back, the small part that goes posteriorly, so we call that the dorsal ramus, and then here is the larger ventral ramus that is going to innervate everything anterior to the vertebral column, okay? And then here is the sympathetic chain that is running vertically on either side of the spinal cord, and this is how sympathetic information gets into the sympathetic chain via the rami communicantes. All right, so this is just a different illustration of what we've looked at so far. Okay. All right, so let's look at this question right here. Let me see if it still makes sense. And then let's see if I can figure out what the answer is. Or maybe you can figure it out. What branch of a spinal nerve, all right, so what kind of nerves are we talking about? Where are they coming from? Brain or spinal cord? spinal cord, number 31 pairs, carries afferent and efferent information to your erector spinae muscles. So here are your choices. Ventral root. Does it carry afferent and efferent? Does that root carry afferent and efferent?
No.
Cross it off. What about the dorsal root?
No.
No, cross that one off. What about the ventral rami?
No.
Ventral rami to the what? Erector spinae muscles?
No.
Are the erector spinae ventral to the spinal cord?
No,
no, cross that one out. Dorsal rami?
No.
Yeah, that's it. And then just for fun, I put rami communicantes. Why yes that one or why no that one? Because that carries sympathetic information to the sympathetic chain ganglia, not somatic information to the erector spinae muscle, right? So erector spinae is voluntary muscle. It's innervated by a somatic neuron. But the rami communicantes has what? Autonomic information, not somatic information going through it. Okay, so this is some pretty cool neuroanatomy. All right, I do want you to know, of all the nerves that we can look at, two nerves. In lab, you might have to know maybe a couple more than that. But for lecture, I think this is fine. Okay, these two nerves. All right, let me look here. Ah, this is good. Okay. All right, so here we see the whole spinal cord, right, from foramen magnum down to about L2. You see the conus medullaris. What is all this stuff right here? Yeah, the cauda equina and then the phylum terminale that anchors the conus medullaris down to the sacrum. And you see the cervical enlargement, lumbar enlargement that houses all of the interneurons for reflexes involving the upper appendage and lower appendage. Okay? And then I see kind of a mess of things. I see like a ball of spaghetti here and a ball of spaghetti right over here. And then down over here and down over here where nerves split apart, we call that bifurcation, and then where they come back together again. We call that anastomos, where they join together. All right? So this is what we call a plexus. All right, this network of nerves is called a plexus, and there are four plexes that you should be aware of. This is in the cervical region, so we call this the cervical plexus. And then a little bit inferior to that is the brachial plexus. And then way down over here is the lumbar plexus, and even more inferior to the lumbar plexus is the sacral plexus right here. All right. So, how many different ways do you know of to get to school in the morning? Do you know just one way?
Yeah.
Couple different, you know one way, okay. Anybody know more than one way? Yeah, okay. Now, why is it a good idea to know a number of different ways to get from where you are to where you want to go? Why might that be important?
Traffic.
And who cares? Because there's traffic sometimes, or there might be a SIG alert. Right, maybe you're coming down the 605 and there's a big crash on the 605 and you want to get off the 605 and take a surface street to get to where you want to go, right? So that's the beauty of these different plexes right here, all right? Which means that if one of these nerves gets damaged, your body has a way to work around that damaged area and still send information to a part of your body so that you don't lose control of that part of your body. So these nerve plexes allow alternate routes for information to go from the spinal cord to important organs that are inside your body. All right, so information can take all kinds of different ways to get to where it needs to go in case one of those nerves or maybe more than one nerve gets damaged. And nerves can get damaged all the time. All right, one important nerve goes to the diaphragm. What do you know about the diaphragm? Yeah, what kind of muscle is it?
Skeletal.
It's skeletal muscle. Excellent, it is skeletal muscle. A lot of times you don't have to think about it, but it is skeletal muscle because you can prevent it from contracting or you can contract it rapidly and hyperventilate, right? So it is skeletal muscle. There's a nerve that goes to the diaphragm that causes it to contract, which allows you to inhale, to breathe. Now, is breathing a good thing?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. You couldn't live very long without breathing, right? So how important is that nerve?
Very
important. The name of that nerve is the phrenic nerve. The phrenic nerve comes all the way from this cervical plexus right here and ends up where? Right at the junction between the thoracic cavity and the abdominal cavity. It has to travel a long way. So, since it's an important nerve, you think that it would be a good idea for breathing signals to get to the diaphragm via a number of different routes in case one of the nerves gets damaged. Yeah, because if the nerve, one nerve gets damaged, then you would die. But if there's a plexus along the way that can share information with various nerves, right, you're not automatically going to die. Okay, so the origin of the phrenic nerve is from C3, C4, and C5. That's where the nerves are going to issue from, and they're going to participate in the cervical plexus. All right, so let's see if we can find where that is. Let me go back, look up over here someplace. I think this is, here. All right, so here's the cervical plexus. C1 is the spinal nerve that comes out between the occipital bone and C1. What's C1? The first cervical vertebrae. What's the name for the first cervical vertebrae? Atlas, yeah. So here is that nerve that comes out between the occipital bone and C1. Here's the spinal nerve that comes out between C1 and C2. Here's the one between C2 and C3. All right, so this is how we label them. All right, now where is that phrenic nerve? Here's the phrenic nerve, and where is that going to go? All the way down to the diaphragm. All right, now where does this phrenic nerve get innervation from? What about C5? Yeah, there it is right here. What about C4? Yeah, what about here? And what about C3? Yeah. All right, so here is a cervical plexus, which contributes axons to the phrenic nerve, right, from C3, 4, and 5 to make sure that you can keep breathing. All right, so here's another little, it's not a mnemonic, but it's just kind of a little fun saying to help remember the origins of the phrenic nerve, right? And the origins are what? C3, 4, and 5. And what does that do? C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. Okay, so C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. So if there is damage to the spinal cord, right, above C3, then you lose that phrenic nerve. But if you have damage to the cervical region, right, to your neck, at between C3 and C4, right, that's not immediately fatal because information can still leave through C3 to get to the diaphragm. All right, so that's the beauty of this plexus right here. All right, so that's the cervical plexus. All these other different nerves you don't have to know about, okay, unless maybe you take a dissection class and you got to know the names of all these different nerves right here, but I want you to know phrenic because it's important, and I want you to know where it originates from, namely C3, 4, and 5, and that this plexus is a beautiful thing because those life-saving signals, right, can take different routes to get to the diaphragm as a result. Okay, another nerve, which is pretty important, is a sciatic nerve, right? It arises from L4, L5, S1, and S2. That goes down to your leg, and let's see if we can find that one. I don't know if I can find that one easily or not. Here we go. Okay. All right, so here's a sacral plexus. Here's the sciatic nerve, right? So you can see coming from L4, L5, S1, and S2 to form the sciatic nerve right here through this plexus. All right, so these aren't exam figures. You don't have to label all of these things, but you should at least know where those nerves are. And in lab, you have some models that you have to be able to identify these structures with. All right, then I think the last thing, was nerve plexus. Oh, but there is something else. There is one last thing. Okay, a dermatome. Let's go back to a picture of the spinal cord. Okay. All right, so here we see a number of spinal nerves, actually all 31 of them. All right, so let's look at a spinal nerve maybe from this thoracic region right here. And this nerve, this spinal nerve, is going to innervate about this region of the body. It's not going to innervate anything up in the head or the neck, right, or in the arm or down in the leg. It's going to be responsible for just this one area right here. So that if it was, if we're going to monitor the sensory nerves, we could stick a pin over here someplace, right, and that information wouldn't be carried by this particular nerve. So if we anesthetized this nerve and stuck a pin over here, would a person feel that pin hit them in the back? If we only anesthetize this nerve on the left side of the body and we stuck a pin on the right side, they'd still feel it. Okay? They'd still feel it. Okay? Or if we stuck a pin up over here, they'd feel it. But if we, and their pin down over here, they'd feel it. But if we stuck a pin right here, what would happen? They wouldn't feel it, right? Because there is a sensory area on the surface of your body that works with this spinal nerve, and only this one spinal nerve. So we can map out the area of sensation for each one of these spinal nerves right here, and we call that a dermatome. So let me show you a picture of a dermatome. Here's a dermatome. All right, so this is a map of the sensory area on your body corresponding to a particular spinal nerve. All right, so on your anterior leg right here, what spinal nerve is responsible for transmitting information to the spinal cord? It would be L5. Okay, so here is that whole area right here. So these are particularly handy because maybe somebody has a sensory deficit in a certain part of their body, and a neurologist can tell, right, by placing some pressure or a pin, right, on different parts of somebody's leg, and they can now tell you exactly where the lesion is. It's going to be on the L5 spinal nerve, right? So that's particularly handy, right? Or if there's a sensory deficit right here, then you know it's at L3. Right, and when you know that information, then you can order a nice MRI scan just of that area, a nice high-resolution scan, and really get a good idea of where the pathology exists. Right, so that's a nice way of localizing a particular injury. All right, so this is a dermatome map. All right, so that's it for peripheral nervous system. All right, so make sure you know the difference between a root and a rami. Which one's mixed? Rami, that's right. Roots are either motor or sensory, but they're never mixed. Okay? Okay. What's the name of the nerve that originates from C3, 4, and 5? Phrenic nerve, right. Okay. What about the olfactory nerve? Is it sensory or motor or mixed? Sensory, right? Because here's that little sign. Some say money matters, right? So that's just purely sensory. Okay, but you don't have any muscles in your nose anyway. That would be pretty easy to figure out. Okay, that's it for peripheral nervous system. And now, autonomic nervous system. I'm going to close this down, open up autonomic nervous system. All right, so what are the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system? Smooth muscle. Glands and cardiac muscle. All right, those three effector organs. Okay. And I tell you what, let me get some pictures also going. Chapter 15. All right, what did I say here? All right, so the autonomic nervous system controls involuntary or self-governing systems of the body, such as blood pressure, because it sends signals to smooth muscle and blood vessels. It sends signals to the heart, which are involuntary muscles. It adjusts heart rate, it adjusts digestion and respiration, urination, sweating, pupil dilation, and just a lot of different functions all over your body. Okay? And it does that by adjusting or controlling either smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or glands, or all three of these things right here. Okay. So let's compare and contrast the neuroanatomy of the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. What's another name for somatic? Somatic? Voluntary, right? I put them both here together, somatic and voluntary. That's, I think, what is that, an oxymoron when you use the same term? Two different words that mean the same thing together. All right, somatic means what? Means voluntary. All right, and autonomic means what? Automatic or visceral. Okay. So the two pathways that we want to know something about are either a somatic pathway or an autonomic pathway. And you're pretty much familiar with that somatic pathway already. Okay. How many neurons does it take? Oh, I don't want that. How many neurons does it take to get from the spinal cord to, what's the effector organ for a somatic pathway? Skeletal muscle. How many neurons does it take? Just one. Yeah, we looked at that already. The nerve cell body is in, what, the anterior horn, and it goes out the ventral root, and is it myelinated or non-myelinated? It's myelinated, right? And it goes all the way to the skeletal muscle where you have the neuromuscular junction. That's all one neuron that does that. Can you remember what kind of neuron that is by its shape? Yeah, it's a nice multipolar neuron. Okay. Now, the same thing for the autonomic nervous system. It's a multipolar neuron, but the nerve cell bodies are in a little bit different location. At least for the sympathetic nervous system, they're in the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. But since it's a motor neuron, it has to leave which root?
Ventral
root. Okay. And then it's going to diverge, get into that sympathetic chain ganglion. So here's a sympathetic chain ganglion, for instance, or maybe just some autonomic ganglion. And what is a ganglion? Anybody remember a definition of a ganglion? Group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, where? CNS or PNS? In the peripheral nervous system, right? So it's just gray matter. So here's going to be a group of thousands and thousands of them. All right? And since there's a cell body right here, and this is the axon terminus of this first neuron, right? How many neurons does it take to get from the from the spinal cord to an effector organ, which is smooth muscle in this particular illustration? It is two. And in 99.9% of the cases, all autonomic pathways require two neurons. All right, here's the first one, here's the second one. But what about for a somatic pathway? Just one. So that's a huge difference. Okay. Furthermore, I could ask you, what's the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction for a somatic motor pathway? Acetylcholine. Fantastic. All right. Now, let's look at this autonomic pathway right here. Okay, we said that it requires two neurons. Right, and here is a ganglion where there's a synapse. So the neuron that comes before the ganglion is called the preganglionic neuron, and the one that comes after the ganglion is the postganglionic neuron. Right, so we got preganglionic and postganglionic, because an autonomic pathway is always going to require two neurons. Okay, so this is a nice autonomic ganglion. And this is a chemical synapse. So what carries information across the synapse right here? Is it a chemical signal or an electrical signal? It's a chemical signal. And That's what we call a neurotransmitter, once again. And in all autonomic ganglia, the neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine, just like the neuromuscular junction. So that's pretty nice and simple to remember. Okay. Neurons that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter are called cholinergic neurons. So the preganglionic neuron is a cholinergic neuron that starts an electrical signal in the postganglionic axon, which goes all the way down to this effector organ. And these are chemical synapses as well. Ooh, let me zoom into this region right here. Okay. But now these synapses are a little bit different. Remember, for the neuromuscular junction, neurotransmitter is released only from the axon terminus, but for an autonomic axon, it's released from each one of these little bulges along the pathway of the axon. And remember, these little bulges right here are called varicosities. So there's a little bit different. Now, the neurotransmitter that's released here for autonomic effectors is not acetylcholine. It's a different neurotransmitter. And it's really important that you get to know the name of that neurotransmitter. It is norepinephrine. Okay? Probably you've heard of norepinephrine. There is a compound that's kind of similar to norepinephrine that's called epinephrine. Okay? But there is even a more common name for epinephrine that we use all the time, even when we're growing up. That's called adrenaline. So epinephrine and adrenaline are the same, exact same compound. And norepinephrine and noradrenaline are the exact same compound. But usually most people don't say noradrenaline, okay, but you could if you wanted to. So that's the neurotransmitter released from which neuron in an autonomic pathway? The postganglionic axon releases norepinephrine, right? Or you could say noradrenaline. So these fibers right here, these nerve fibers right here, we don't call them cholinergic because they don't release acetylcholine. We call them adrenergic because they release noradrenaline or adrenaline. Okay, so there's a difference between cholinergic and adrenergic. So here's a pretty good slide, okay? Because you see the architecture of the nervous system, the ventral root is for motor pathways, right? And for a somatic pathway, how many neurons does it take to get to the effector organ? Just one, and the effector organ is skeletal muscle. But for an autonomic pathway, it's going to require two in every particular case. The neurotransmitter at the ganglion is acetylcholine. And for sympathetic postganglionic fibers, the neurotransmitter is norepinephrine. Okay. And then make sure you know that the effector organs for the autonomic pathway is either smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, or glands. Okay. Okay. So that's a pretty good introduction. Okay. Well, let's just try a couple of these questions. What's the effector in the somatic voluntary pathway? Skeletal muscle. What are the effectors in the autonomic or visceral motor pathway? Smooth muscle, glands, cardiac muscle, right, okay. Okay, I do want to say something about some general architecture. We've kind of talked about this topic already. Has to do with control systems, right? So there are maybe two main ways that a system can be controlled, right? There's something called tonic control, and then there's something called antagonistic control. Which one do you think is better? Okay, yeah, that's good because we talked about that already. But usually antagonism has kind of what, a bad connotation to it because you don't want to be around antagonistic people, right, all the time. So, but let me tell you why it's a good thing. Okay, a tonic control describes a system where a single effector can be adjusted either on or off or maybe up or down, okay? So, for instance, in your automobile, it would be a control system that can maybe accelerate your car. Okay, it can accelerate it fast, right, or slowly. And what would be the device on your car which makes your car go? The accelerator, right? Or there could be another device that stops your car. What do you call that?
Brake.
The brake, Okay, so a tonic control means that you would have either the accelerator pedal or the brake pedal, but not both of them. And would you ever consider driving your car with just the accelerator and not a brake pedal? That's not much fun. Has that ever happened to anybody in here? I mean, I'm the only person that's happened to a couple of times. It was a Honda, actually. It was a little Honda that was about this big that was stored in somebody's garage for a long time. It was before I think they were even sold in the United States. It was a really small Honda. And we were so excited to get the engine running after it was in storage that we didn't check the brakes. You know, we were stupid kids in high school and got the engine running after working on it and drove down the alley and then stepped on the brake pedal and there was nothing there. That was, oh, dang, should have checked the brakes. Didn't crash because I think the parking brake still kind of worked. Okay. So, yeah, so that's no fun, right? So antagonistic control. Oh, another way of thinking about the difference between antagonistic and tonic control is, say if you have a water faucet, okay, and if you want water at a particular temperature, right, how many valves do you want, or what do you want to do? You want to mix a cold signal with a hot signal to get, like, whatever water temperature you want, right? If you want it cold, you can have cold. If you want it hot, you can have hot. And if you want medium temperature, you just mix the two signals together to get the precise temperature you want. So antagonism is really a good thing. What about in the musculoskeletal system? What are two muscles that give a part of your body precise control and balance? Oh, but muscles. Biceps and triceps, right? So you have precise control over your forearm. That's really, really important. Okay. And so that's the reason why the autonomic nervous system has two divisions to it that are antagonistic, right? So one is going to be like the accelerator and the other is going to be like the brake pedal in your car. And so that's really the important thing that you can say about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system is that they're always going to have opposite effects. You can't say that the parasympathetic will always be like the accelerator, or you can't say that the parasympathetic will always be like the brake pedal. You can just say that between the two, they're going to have opposite effects. Okay, and then I'll show you a trick to figure out how it goes. So let's talk about the parasympathetic nervous system first. All right, and then we'll talk about the sympathetic nervous system. All right, the nerve cell bodies are in the brain stem. Where's the brain stem at? What part of the body is your brain stem? Is it peripheral nervous system? Central nervous system. Now, where in the central nervous system? It's in your brain. Okay? What kind of nerves come from your brain? Cranial nerves. Right? So parasympathetic outflow or parasympathetic information can leave through some cranial nerves. Right? And as a matter of fact, we talked about one really important one, the one that wanders around all over your body. The vagabond, which is what? Vagus nerve, what number is that? Number 10, okay. Okay. And then also, parasympathetic outflow can leave the spinal cord through S2, S3, and S4. Where the heck are these at? Yeah, sacral outflow, sacral nerves. Those are the only two places where parasympathetic information can leave the spinal cord, through cranial nerves or through sacral nerves. And what do you got in between? Well, a lot of nerves leaving the central nervous system, but no parasympathetic information leaves only. So, therefore, we call the parasympathetic division craniosacral outflow because outflow only comes from some cranial nerves and some sacral nerves, but no nerves in between. Craniosacral outflow. So, let's look at a nice picture of this. Where's craniosacral outflow at? I've got it. This one might be too complicated to look at. Ah, here. Now this is it. Okay. So parasympathetic in these illustrations is going to be this color right here. What is that? Dark blue?
Purple.
Even better yet. All right, so where does parasympathetic information leave the central nervous system? From the brain or from the sacral regions right here and nothing in between, right? I don't see any purple nerves leaving anywhere in here. So therefore, parasympathetic is what? Cranial sacral outflow. And here's a nerve that wanders around all over the body, going to the heart, the lungs, the liver, stomach, pancreas, all these intestines over here, right? And that's cranial nerve number 10, right? The vagabond, vagus nerve. Okay. Now, how many nerves does it take to get from the CNS to the effector organ? For an autonomic pathway?
Two.
Okay. So here is the first one. What do we call the first one? Preganglionic, and it's a solid, well, let's go to this one right here. It's a solid color. Here's a ganglion, so here's the postganglionic fiber, and what does it look like? Is it a solid colored line? It's dashed. Okay. That dashed line means that it is non-myelinated. It's an older kind of neuron. It's not very fast. It's non-myelinated, so the preganglionic is myelinated. The postganglionic is not myelinated. Okay. Another important feature of the parasympathetic nervous system is that the preganglionic fiber is long and the postganglionic fiber is short, right? So those are some other differences. Preganglionic myelinated, post non-myelinated, preganglionic relatively long, postganglionic relatively short. The neurotransmitter used at the ganglion is always acetylcholine, and the neurotransmitter used by the postganglionic cell for parasympathetic is also acetylcholine. So both the pre- and postganglionic fibers are what we call cholinergic neurons for the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so that's parasympathetic nervous system. So this ganglion, since the preganglionic fiber is really long, these ganglia are very close to the target organ, or maybe even inside the target organ. Sometimes we call it a terminal ganglion. They're right there. All right, so what are some of the targets? This is what I want you to know for the effects of the parasympathetic nervous system. Even though it has thousands of different effects in the body, here are four that I want you to know something about. Parasympathetic stimulation decreases heart rate. Parasympathetic nerves slow your heart rate down, and if the stimulation is severe, it can actually stop your heart. What do you think of that? Good or bad? Yeah, you're dead, not good, right? That's kind of important, for instance, because maybe somebody's doing some surgery on your neck where this vagus nerve goes and they're not aware of that and they stimulate this vagus nerve. Guess what happens? It could stop the heart. So sometimes this vagus nerve has to be blocked if you're doing surgery anywhere close to it on a living person, okay? Okay. So parasympathetic inhibits the heart. Now, what about digestion? What's parasympathetic effects on digestion? Does it inhibit? It does not inhibit. It goes the other way. It stimulates digestion. And this will make sense in a little bit. I don't know if I can make sense of it today or not. Probably not. And respiration, what about parasympathetic on respiration? Slows it down, and then your pupils, right, can dilate or constrict. It causes pupil constriction. Okay. And I guess I'm going to have to stop here. So next time we're going to get to sympathetic, and then we'll compare and contrast. So you know what? Over the weekend, really study this autonomic chapter because it can be really confusing, right? And if you study it ahead of time, then lecture will make a whole lot more sense for you. Okay, and then the next chapter is really fun. That's senses. We get to look at the eyeball and all that stuff.